Good afternoon. It's Friday the 11th of October 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me by video link today is Alex Thompson. Welcome to the programme, Alex.
Good to be with you, Mike. Thank you. And apologies in advance about the builders' noises that people will be hearing in the background.
Well, no problem. Let's start straight away with Brexit. I'm sorry to do that, everybody, but I'm afraid that's probably the for the next week or two, at least, the biggest story. Apparently, there's been a Brexit love island because Boris was over to Ireland to meet Leo Varadkar yesterday, and they seem to have got on very well. New talks have taken place today as a result. Stephen Barclay over in Brussels to meet Michel Barnier today. So it remains to be seen whether any fundamental breakthrough is made. Johnson said yesterday that there was a pathway to a deal, that everything, Leo Varadkar said that the meeting was very positive. And so it went on. Donald Tusk today, well, it depends which mainstream media outlet you read, if you read any of them, to discover whether he said was positive or negative. But his statement was pretty clear that yesterday when the Irish Taoiseach and the UK Prime Minister met, they both saw for the first time a pathway to a deal, ever received positive signals from the Taoiseach that a deal is still possible. So, Alex, I'm interested in your views on this. Of course, the deal is with respect to the Irish border, and that's really the only thing that's being discussed at this point. Other than that, it seems that the deal isn't going to be too different to the one that Theresa May proposed.
Well, if there were any substantial differences, Mike, I'm quite sure that they would have been emblazoned all over the mainstream press and would have been a subject of fierce debate in the parliamentary weeks of debate, so-called, that we've just had. But as it is, and David Scott has pointed this out very well, the most substantial issue mulled over by either press or members of parliament in the last couple of weeks has been the Prime Minister's use of the word humbug. To the extent that we might call this last parliament, which called so hard for it to be called into existence out of prorogation, we might dub it the humbug parliament for all the good it's done.
Absolutely. Now, we mentioned on Wednesday, of course, that parliament had been prorogued again. They didn't seem to achieve very much in the period between the court case and the return of parliament and the re-prorogation. It was really a bit of a pointless exercise, the entire court case, other than it apparently has made some pretty fundamental constitutional changes.
We are seeing the groundswell for constitutional wrecking really reaching a pitch now. Down there in Plymouth, of course, one of your local members of parliament is the celebrated Gary Streeter, not Brian and yours best friend, of course. And Mr. Streeter is now telling the local rag, the Plymouth Herald, that it is time for a written constitution, a federal United Kingdom, a unicameral legislature for England, and all kinds of bells and whistles which people have been calling for years. And he, of course, is coming at it from the local right wing of the Conservative Party. And now we see the false opposition that there was, because all these ideas were regarded as progressive and Lib Dem or Labour or SNP ideas for a long time. And all of a sudden we see that they're actually in the Conservative Party too. So this is really the end game that was intended, I think, through and even before all this Brexit shenanigans of 3 years, is that we must wreck the existing constitution.
Alex, a lot of people on both sides of the argument calling for constitutional reform and of course, the old mantra that the constitution is unwritten keeps being pushed forward. But at times like these, it's particularly when there's such a groundswell of sort of pro-European feeling within Parliament, it's a pretty dangerous time to start talking about significant constitutional reform, because we're going to end up with a European style. It's going to look European in style anyway.
We are really lined up to be spit roasted here. If we're not careful, we're going to be Sorosified. And I think many of our viewers will know of a YouTube channel called Amazing Polly, who does deep research. Well, in a nutshell yesterday, she explained what being Soros is all about. It is that you have a series of revolutions which have been carefully bred in the potting shed, in the nursery of student groups and disaffected civil society groups. And then when people come out on the streets, whether it's a violent Eastern European style revolution or something more British and low key, The effect is that, as she puts it, the mob is got up to believe that it wants a new written constitution and a whole load of anti-corruption bodies, so-called. And the existence, the calling into being of this plethora of anti-corruption bodies is itself the corruption. It allows so-called civil society in the new participative democracy model to claim that it is implementing the people's will. So that when the people come out on the streets and say, no, this is not what we had in mind, the corrupt people have already got their feet under the table and have got a new document to base themselves on. So it's the theft of the idea of acting in the name of the people which is going on here. Of course, acting in the name of the people is the Crown's prerogative, nobody else's.
Absolutely. Now, of course, the big issue that's apparently getting the most coverage at the moment is the Northern Irish border. Well, you wanted to highlight this. This is from Schengen Visa Info website. Denmark introduces internal border checks with Sweden, extends those with Germany. So they're saying that the border controls with Germany have been extended for another 6 months. How does this work if keeping open internal borders is absolutely a requirement of being in the single market and the customs union? Why do we suddenly have certain countries with border controls?
There have actually been dozens of such infringements of the Schengen agreement in the last year, Mike. I think we're up into the 20s, if not the 30s, of such infringements. Denmark, not for the first time, has decided that it has big problems with motorbike gang-based criminality coming over the new bridge from Sweden and with criminality coming in from Germany. And so, not for the first time in either case, they are putting systematic controls in place, even though these three countries, Denmark and its northern and southern neighbours, are all in the Schengen zone. Meanwhile, Germany's southern neighbour has checks for people coming in from Austria, and Austria in turn has checks for people coming in from Hungary and Slovenia. In other words, the Balkan migration route being clamped down on. And with all of this going on, we're told that the United Kingdom and Ireland must, in any kind of EU exit for Britain, have an open border. It makes no sense at all. Even before either country, Britain or Ireland, was in the EEC, there was, of course, under the Common Travel Agreement, there was a freedom of movement and of employment. And yet, as you will remember from your childhood, security situation requirements were often such that people had to be stopped and asked basic questions about what they were doing.
Absolutely. And in fact, the Common Travel Area has existed for decades. It continues to exist now, and the British government insisting that no matter what happens with Brexit, the Common Travel Area will continue. So, it's an interesting development. Now, let's move on to this as related to Brexit in many ways. This a week or so ago, we reported the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, and that they were stating that only the young and the stupid don't get their news from public service broadcasters. That's the main news item still on their website there. Well, they, along with this organisation, the UK and Changing Europe, were hosting an event yesterday on Brexit and the media. This was really the sentiment from the chairman of the Reuters Institute of the Study of Journalism. He said that British press is being played like an instrument and it doesn't care. It's very hard for me to accept. He said that British journalists don't understand what's going on. Of course they do. And so he's really being quite critical about the way that the British press is reporting what's going on with Brexit. And Alex, as we were looking through the British press this morning and the headlines and the media coverage of Brexit, it continues to be this inflammatory coverage, which is disingenuous at best. It certainly, in some cases, could be described as out-and-out fake news.
Well, I see the quality and the honesty of the British mainstream press reporting on particularly Brexit issues actually going downhill by the week now, Mike. I think a particularly egregious example was just in the last couple of days, of course, very controversial. Nigel Farage got a great deal of coverage for calling Judith Bunting, a new Liberal Democrat MEP who took up her seat this summer, a stuck-up snob. Or even more colourful language than that, I think. And what struck me is that both the pro-Brexit and the sceptical about Brexit papers simply referred to Mrs. Bunting, or Ms. Bunting, whatever she is, as a Liberal Democrat MEP, repeatedly, even though they could simply have gone to YouTube and they could have heard the Irish Deputy Speaker of the European Parliament, who was in the chair, say, Mrs. Bunting. That's all it takes, 5 seconds of searching and backwards reeling on YouTube. Not even that level of search is being done now. I mean, this copy seems to be written by people who are, you know, just fresh out of college.
Well, it's not only that. Part of the commentary that was being made there was that, of course, people are expected to churn out 10, 800 word articles a day. It is not possible for particularly young, inexperienced journalists to do anything better than they're doing. They're producing, well, Brian uses the word dross a lot, but that they're producing low quality, incorrect information in most cases. It's not necessarily their fault. It is absolutely the fault of the organisations, of the media organisations.
I think that would be a fair assessment. I mean, journalism is, of course, a writing profession. Writing professions tend to attract mainly conscientious people, even if they've got utopian ideas in their heads. People go in to tell stories and change hearts and minds. And so they tend to care rather deeply about what they are writing. And of course, just as with studying literature at university, so honing your journalistic skills is really something that you have to learn by falling flat on your face a lot and being mercilessly corrected by older colleagues. And that's the step that has crucially gone missing, I think, now.
Absolutely. Well, we've had this gentleman on the screen a few times over many years now, Will Moy. He is head of Full Fact. And of course, Full Fact has the contract with Facebook to do all of Facebook's fact checking in the UK. So he was also taking part in this media Brexit media conference and commenting on the situation with respect to fact checking. And he had this to say. He said, if the game is that some people will put out false information and others put out true information, and the true information has to reach all the people that read the false information, then that game is not capable of being won. Now, assuming that he is coming from the position that the mainstream media is the group which is putting out the true information, that's quite an admission there from him.
The way that I understand that, when you just read it out to me there, is a positive gloss on the idea that you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all of the time. I have not seen an admission like this, even a realist, let alone defeatist, air by these sock puppet fact-checking organisations on any channel before. And for him to be admitting it now suggests to me that over this summer period, things have definitively swung against the mainstream narrative.
Well, let's just look at how far the mainstream narrative has gone, because here is the Mail from yesterday, I think. Wednesday afternoon, actually. Russia deploys top secret unit of assassins and spies to spread turmoil in UK and across Europe. And they're saying that previously unknown Kremlin spy unit believed behind series of plots in Europe, unit 29155, blamed for poisoning Sergei Skripal and launching Montenegro coup. The spy unit is comprised of veterans from Afghan, Chechnya and Ukraine wars. Retired GRU officer says unit 29155 exists to carry out murders and bombings. And so it goes on. Explain that this is written by a young journalist called Sebastian Murphy Bates. This is what he looks like. So I'm not clear what qualifies him to actually report this. As far as I know, he has a master's in religious studies, something along those lines, although he calls himself a left-wing atheist. But who do they run to for their expert opinion? It's none other than this man, Dr. Victor Madeira, who, of course, works for the Institute for Statecraft, i.e. the Integrity Initiative, or at least the Integrity Initiative is their program. He apparently said that the Kremlin under Putin regards itself as locked in a political, psychological war with the West. Alex, how at this point could Putin regard himself as being locked into anything other than a political, psychological war with the West, because the West is attacking him at every opportunity?
Well, there is the old saying, isn't there, Mike? Just because I'm paranoid does not mean they're not persecuting me. And as for Dr. Madeira there, I was really put in mind of the old Flanders and Swan song, "Have some Madeira, Madeira." In other words, you know, a quick swig of some numbing alcohol will persuade you to do things or believe things that when you were sober, you wouldn't. Now, this is, I don't know how much more you have on that story, but I have a few things to say about it. Were there any more slides for that?
Okay. Go ahead, Alex, go ahead.
Well, I mean, people can look at it for themselves, but it's Michael Schwirtz, S-C-H-W-I-R-T-Z, of the New York Times, who's come out with this unit 29155 scare. You can find it taken apart in by numerous people, including the excellent Kit Klarenberg, who I'm sure many of our viewers know of, and Twitter and other channels. But the key point is that this is a new low for what we were just talking about a moment ago, which is a mainstream journalist not checking their own side's narrative, because it was actually the Western Intelligence and Western Foreign Ministry-funded outfit, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, so our own propaganda outfits and mouthpieces for Eastern Europe, which reported last year on this obscure military unit, 29155, and found that it was openly discussed by a simple search return on Yandex, the Russian search engine, or any of the others, and was found to be a specialist training outfit with an acknowledged Moscow headquarters address. And the commander's name is given. We know that he was born in Ashgabat, now in Turkmenistan. We even know from the Russian equivalent of the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Authority that he drives a clapped-out old car. The registration's there. Even his phone number is there. And Radio Free Europe's own people, Russian speakers, of course, have turned on Michael Schwirtz and said, have you not even acknowledged that we were reporting the existence of this unit last year with no suggestion that it was to do with sending military men into the West? It was, if anything, to do with information operations. And so even the mainstream press is now split between those who speak Russian and can do a simple internet search in Russian and the much more exalted, rarefied creatures of the New York Times and the Telegraph and the Guardian, who for whom, you know, such things are far beneath them. And they just write the line to take, which is Unit 29155 is the unit which has been sent to destabilize Europe and assassinate people. And the great and the good of Twitter are sharing this with, you know, spooked out comments like, finally, we found out who the bad guys are. It's just laughable.
We're talking about the incompetence of the mainstream media earlier on, for whatever reason. But is this really the best that Andy Price's counter-disinformation and media development team at the Foreign Office can do?
Well, if so, then it means that journalism is not the only profession that's lost its talent pool and hasn't had a pipeline training new people, because Andy Price's outfit, or his talent pool, is supposed to be the Foreign Commonwealth Office, and particularly the Russianist and the Eastern European specialists, who were second to none in the world until 10 years ago or less. And the good ones have scarpered, of course. They've seen what the lark is, and they're out of there. The ones I respected anyway seem to have taken a bow out. And there's been no training of serious people. You know, we see this also with the Americans allowing a Russian senator who sits on the Russian Senate's Foreign Affairs Committee into the United States, a rather strikingly attractive woman of 34 who was there actually to have a serious dialogue in the Fort Ross forum to try to ease tensions with Russia and America. And as soon as she arrives in New York, she's taken off into a side room by the FBI, grilled for an hour with inappropriate, which probably means sexually suggestive questions. And after an hour, as if in a line from a bad comedy film, the FBI says, well, you know, dear, we don't have to carry this on in this uncomfortable setting. You and I could knock off to a restaurant around the corner. You know, this really keystone cop level of behavior now by the security and intelligence agencies, their ghostwriters, as well as the journalists whom they rely upon.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because Dr. Victor Madeira, that image is taken from his evidence session, I think it was March 2016, to the Defense Committee, where he was saying exactly that Britain used to have a top-class Russian section within the Foreign Office, and that it has lost that ability and that skill. Somebody must have taken that must have been a policy decision.
I lived through those years. I shadowed those guys, the very elite guys who interpreted the Prime Minister to President level phone calls. I wrote the reports for them. I saw how they scattered to the four winds because they were being wrung out like a sponge. Their advice was not being believed, and they were having to brief politicized, shall we say, jobbing desk officers, because these were the deep specialists behind the desk officers. The desk officers were chopping and changing every 6 months, and each one was less competent than the last, and each foreign secretary and junior minister at the Foreign Office was less competent than the last. It's no wonder that they all scarpered in the 2000s.
Yes, okay. Well, let's move on then. If you like what the UK Column's doing and you would like to support us, your support would be much appreciated. Please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. There are options there for joining us or making a donation. It would be much appreciated, as I say. Well, tonight is the last night of Ian Crane's whistle-stop tour of the UK. Absolutely superb effort. Asking 5G, is it safe? And the final event tonight in Cardiff in the Angel Hotel. Do get along to that if you possibly can. And a quick reminder that AV 10.1 taking place in London on the 27th of October, and four or five speakers at that. Fantastic event on the cards there. Do get along to alternativeview.co.uk if you want tickets for that. Well, today is International Day of the Girl Child. And unfortunately, and I say that dripping with sarcasm, unfortunately, Greta Thunberg has not won the Nobel Peace Prize this year. Instead, it has gone to Abiy Ahmed Ali, who's the Prime Minister of Ethiopia. Well, The Spectator was asking this morning, will Greta win the Nobel Peace Prize today? Really, they were hoping quite a lot that she didn't, and she hasn't. So is this the Nobel Committee showing an ounce of sanity here, do you think, Alex?
Well, I was wandering through Oslo this summer, Mike, and I saw the building from which the Nobel Prize Committee hand out their stuff, and I was shocked how social justice warrior the whole thing was. So I thought really that she would have been a shoo-in. But perhaps they've learned a salutary lesson for, well, it's a full 10 years ago now, isn't it? At the time that they awarded the newly elected President Obama the Nobel Peace Prize for future contributions to world peace before he blew up several countries.
Absolutely. Now, what do you think of awarding it to the person they have awarded it to?
Ethiopia is a tricky one. Basically, this is the pinch point of where China, Israel, Russia, the United States and Europe all want their inroads into Africa. Mm-hmm. They want something in and they want something out. They want to put neo-colonialists in, all of them, and they want to extract surplus young males to work in their respective jurisdictions or parts of the world. Ethiopia is very much at the hub of that. It's got a massive excess population. It's been deliberately misgoverned with Western connivance for a long time. They've had massive ethnic tensions. It's anyone's guess how to reform Ethiopia. There seem to be very strongly divided opinions on it. But I think it's another case of them hoping against hope that their chosen man is not going to turn out to be another Isaias Afwerki, who, you know, a good friend of Tony Blair's, who ended up genociding his people there. That tends to happen rather a lot in the Horn of Africa.
Yes. Yes. OK, well, look, let's move on to Scotland. And well, this is The Times, and the headline is here, Parents Take on John Swinney Over Porn Lessons in New Curriculum. That's quite a headline.
It is, because parents is deliberately dishonest. Both The Times and The Scottish Sun came to this only yesterday, whereas it had been put out on YouTube by the man asking the question the previous weekend. His name is Richard Lucas. His YouTube channel is easily found, Scottish Family Party. We're not endorsing that or any other party, but it's easily found. And there was disingenuously not a single mention, studiedly no mention, either in the Serious Times or the sexualized, dumbed down Sun, of the fact that it was Mr. Lucas, the chairman of a political party. And he was just described as another dad in both of these articles.
So he intervened in a Q&A with Mr. Swinney. So let's have a listen to what happened. Alex, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show the intervention itself, and then we'll talk about that. And then afterwards, I also want to show a few seconds of how Swinney responded to this intervention. But let's watch the intervention first.
Following on from the previous question about the sex education resources. And I think your answer didn't actually face up to the content of the RSHP resources. I mean, just to go through a few of the things very, very quickly. I mean, right at the beginning of primary school, teaching that sex is assigned at birth and gender is a subjective factor. I think that's a very dangerous and confusing message for young people, and yet that's what's delivered to all children in Scottish schools. The sex education materials, I'm sorry to have to talk about these things, but this is what is being taught in schools. Masturbation is positively promoted in schools. In high schools, licking the anus
remember
is...
Remember that we are going live out here.
This is what's being taught in schools. If this is not suitable to talk about with a group of adults, how can it possibly be suitable to talk about in schools? Yes, on the internet, yeah, that's fine. Right, so to continue, I'm not going to be stopped. So that's presented as a perfectly valid sexual practice. Anal sex is illustrated by a video of a banana being dipped into Nutella and then withdrawn. Pornography, right, pornography. I'm going to say here, this is what's being taught in schools. Pornography is not just taught about, it is positively promoted in these materials. It is positively promoted as something beneficial and helpful. Different genres of pornography are also recommended to pupils. So, I'll get my question very soon.
Please.
I'm just referring to the resources. Mr. Swinney says he's watched them. I'm just pointing out what's in them. For example, it's recommended that pupils explore, for example, facial pornography, which involves ejaculation onto the face. I think it's disgusting. It talks about...
Okay, what I'm talking about is what's being taught in schools. And if I'm about to get to a question, if I haven't been silenced, I'm trying to speak up on behalf of innocence and youth in our schools that's been corrupted by these materials. I will not be silenced.
What's the question?
And my question is...
I'm not asking you to be silenced, but please...
Well, where's the microphone then? I'll ask my question. Okay, this situation. Okay, this situation. I am outlining.
Ask the question. Please.
I am outlining the contents
ask the question.
Of the
ask
Scottish questions. Government sex ask education resources. That's what I have done. I will now ask my question. My question to Mr. Swinney, these materials are not educational, they're corrupting of children. And my question is, having heard some of the detail of the content, I now invite you to re-endorse them, reaffirm your endorsement of them, as you did earlier on.
Well, Alex, my first response to this is that is quite a spectacular response to his intervention, because as he rightly said during in the middle of that, if that material is not suitable for that audience and to be live streamed onto YouTube, how can it possibly be suitable for a high school or primary school audience?
Correct, Mike. The most shocking thing that most people have found about this much shared clip has been the arm-waving lady. Now, the real shocker is this. The arm-waving lady is not officially the Scottish Government. You might think that she was there as a bag carrier for John Swinney, the number two of the Scottish National Party. But no, she is, in fact, Joanna Murphy, the chairwoman of National Parent Forum Scotland. Now, the last word is the giveaway. Scotland, under the SNP, has done what Canada did in the 2000s, which is to tag the name of the country onto the end of a genuine NGO to create a government front NGO. So National Parent Forum Scotland, the last word negates the previous words. It is no longer, therefore, a National Parent Forum. Otherwise, why would this lady be playing Stockholm Syndrome for the sexualization of children, which is what parents are supposed to be there to prevent? No, by putting Scotland on the end, she has become captured in the way that the whole of the third sector is, particularly in Scotland, and bounden to do the bidding of those who pay, which is the Scottish Government. So there she is in a particularly egregious case of cognitive dissonance, because she's there to be basically Scotland's chief parent, although that, I know that title was stupidly given to Nicola Sturgeon, chief mammy, but she's there representing the parents of Scotland, if anyone else does. It's surely her, chairman of that body. But she cannot abide what's being said, because she is there really to protect the Scottish Government. It's the unified government model again, the Scottish model of government.
Absolutely. Well, let's just have a quick look at Swinney's response to this.
Lastly, gentlemen's comments about relationships, sexual health and parenthood.
Now, I accept that in this material there is some there's some very sensitive territory covered, and that's why I answered the gentleman's question in the fashion that I did, that I appreciate there will be a range of views about whether this is appropriate material to be undertaken. A lot of care has been taken and a lot of dialogue and consultation to ensure that the contents of the material are truly age appropriate. And that has involved extensive dialogue with a number of organisations whose confidence I have wanted to make sure was in place around these materials. And one of the most significant points that has driven this debate has been, what do we need responsibly to ensure young people are equipped to handle from the world that is swirling around about them?
So again, Alex, he is trying to fall back on the tired old position. This is just the way the world is. And therefore, we've got to bombard our children with this material to make sure that they're equipped to deal with it. But in fact, there's no evidence whatsoever that this protects children in any way. Quite the contrary. This, in fact, drives these types of thoughts into the minds of children. It's not a productive thing at all. It is a dangerous thing. Where's the precautionary principle in this case? Because, again, with respect to global warming and so on, we have the precautionary principle shoved down our throats, but in this case, and with other cases, one or two other policy areas as well, it's nowhere to be seen.
Mike, wherever we see the precautionary principle thrown out the window, it is because the government and regulatory bodies are actually financially interested in one side of the equation. And we've seen that with 5G, obviously. And here is the same case with pornography. I'm afraid it's a repetition. It bears many comparisons with the 1970s and 80s situation with drugs, particularly in the United States, but then also coming into Britain and Europe as well, which is, you lot are going to do drugs anyway, so here's how to do it safely. So non-judgmental counselling. Then it came in with what seemed quite mild by comparison now. When I was at secondary school in the 90s, it was, here's how to put a condom on because you're all going to do it anyway. And now we've got to the stage, sorry to be blunt, I won't use swear word or anything here, but basically telling primary school children, you lot are all going to engage in analingus and sodomy anyway, so here's how to do it in a consensual and respectful fashion. I don't buy that, particularly when you look at British government and at also Scottish government level at the sweetheart deals that there are with the major internet companies, the providers, the platforms in particular. I'm talking about tax breaks, exchange of ideas between personnel and so on, which create a situation where government cannot rock the boat and cannot stop the lucrative flood of child-targeted pornography. And, of course, there's more lucrative interest at the other end in mopping up the pieces in the counselling. So I'm afraid this actually, how to consume pornography safely as a nine-year-old is, to me, exactly the same, to take an innocent equivalent, of what we have here in the Netherlands, where the association of nurseries and vegetable growers in greenhouses pays for the government to go around primary schools, giving people taste lessons in developing a taste for various vegetables so that you've got new consumers, getting them hooked early. Well, that's an innocuous example, fruit and veg. That's what's going on here with porn, I think. I don't know whether you'd agree.
I agree, absolutely. And I've mentioned this several times before, that, you know, my mother, who was a primary school principal, always held the view that, you know, behaviour issues in schools were not being reflected by programs such as Grange Hill that the BBC was pushing out when we were children, Alex. But in fact, the television programming was driving the behaviour problems in the schools. And that applies equally here, I think, as well. OK, we'll move on then. Well, good news. Jens Stoltenberg will be in London on Monday. This is fantastic stuff because he will be attending the 65th annual session of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And he's going to deliver a keynote speech followed by a question and answer session. So this is fantastic. The question and answer session will be moderated by the president of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, the highly skilled Madeleine Moon MP, of course, the former social worker who knows everything about defence. And later on Monday, Jens Stoltenberg will have meetings with Dominic Raab, the Foreign Minister, Foreign Secretary, and also Secretary of State for Defence, Ben Wallace, if he's still in a job. And on Tuesday, he's going to have a bilateral meeting with Boris Johnson. So that's what's going on there. I'm sure there is plenty of opportunity, Alex, between now and Monday to be bombarding various people with questions with respect to defence union and European defence union. And of course, we've got to remember that the right-hand pillar of EU defence union is the relationship with NATO.
Yes, this is definitely an opportunity to be seized. But even if people are in the London area, of course, it's very unlikely that they'll be able to get anywhere near the protagonists in the NATO meetings, because as we saw the last time they were held in Britain, it was in Cardiff, wasn't it? Although it usually tends to be dismissively called the Wales meeting, as though Cardiff wasn't a city. But when it was held in Cardiff, we had the same problem of unprecedented barricades and not quite strip searches, but people being frisked on the way into city centre. So getting very near people is going to be quite hard, although Extinction Rebellion managed by some dint to get very close to Parliament and government.
Yes, I can't imagine why. But sticking with NATO then, going back a week or two now, we had the NATO Georgia Commission. So this was Stoltenberg visiting Georgia, meeting the Georgian president, Salome Zurabishvili. I deliberately pronounced that incorrectly. How should it be pronounced, Alex?
It's Zurabishvili, but I'm okay with Zurabishvili, actually, given her past where she was recruited from France and then came in and said, I'm going to sweep out all the demons from the Georgian government, and then did nothing of the sort. That's fair enough.
Okay. So they created a statement, a NATO-Georgia Commission statement following this. Basically, allies have now decided to conduct a fresh, as we call it, or a strengthening of the package by 2020. This is the NATO-Georgia package. Georgia is still not a full member of NATO, but they're really working as hard as they can to get there. And in the statement, they say things such as, Georgia is one of the alliance's closest operational partners, an enhanced opportunities partner. Allies highly appreciate Georgia's steadfast support for NATO's operations and missions. Celebrating the fifth anniversary of the substantial NATO-Georgia package, Allied ambassadors and Georgia praise the success of the SNGP implementation achieved through joint efforts by Georgia allies and partner countries. And they go on to say that NATO values Georgia's engagement and contributions to strategic discussion and mutual awareness on the security of the Black Sea region. NATO is further developing dialogue and practical cooperation in this context, including through the SNGP. So a big statement coming out with continuing tightening of relations between NATO and Georgia.
Yes, and thank you for reading that. And apologies to any viewers who may have almost fallen asleep while Mike was doing his best to make that sound lively. I asked Mike to read that for the specific purpose of showing how much of a nothing burger is being spun out here. The whole tenor of that press statement is, we cannot offer you the stepping stone to membership, known as the Membership Action Plan or MAP, because, of course, in 2008 at the NATO summit in Bucharest, Romania, Angela Merkel annoyed the Americans and, to a lesser extent, the British by saying nine to Georgian and Ukrainian accession. So they never got their membership action plans. And upwards of a decade afterwards, these two countries bordering Russia are still in the limbo of being given intensified dialogue, a status that was invented for them before the war 11 years ago with South Ossetia. And they're stuck there. And so they have been given this fob-off, but the West has said it has to be a substantial fob-off because we'd rather like Georgian troops to keep dying for us in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we'll call it a substantial fob-off. We'll call it a substantial NATO-Georgia package, an SNGP. Now, Jens's, Stoltenberg's deputy, Rose Gottemüller, went to a Q&A at the one of the universities in Batumi, Georgia, while she was there. And one of the students pressed her politely on why will we not get a membership action plan? And her reply was, I don't get so hung up on map or no map. I don't need to get into too many details here, says the number two of NATO. The point is that every country who is aspiring to NATO membership has its own path in that direction. In other words, can you please wait another decade or two and fight some more wars for us, and we'll continue to string you along. Now, why is this important? It's because if you finally get your membership of NATO, which even Merkel was sensible enough to realise was a no-go, then you have an Article 5 commitment, which is that the Americans and the British and the Europeans will come and bleed to death for you to stop the Russian tanks. That is how serious this is. And speaking at the Heritage Foundation in the United States this week, the Estonian defense minister, Estonia is like Georgia, it tries to go out on point and provoke wars with Russia, with the West behind them. The Estonian defense minister, Urmas Reinsalu, said to the Heritage Foundation, write-up in USNI News is on the screen now, quote, "We, that is you, Westerners, don't understand that the core idea of NATO is basically risk insurance, that you are ready to die for your neighbor. And this is based solely on the presumption that your neighbor has the same guts. This is like the prisoner's dilemma in reverse," says the Estonian defense minister, "and also that no prisoner will betray those in other cells." Mike, what's going on here where Estonia is telling Britain and America that they are fellow prisoners in NATO and that they must not betray Estonia by failing to die for it?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not sure that I have an answer for it. I don't really know how to respond to that. It's quite a statement.
You can say that again. And that is what we're going to be in with Ukraine and Georgia, which have existing hot wars with Russia, undeclared hot wars on their territory. The day that Ukraine and Georgia are offered even a membership action plan, let alone full membership, we are signed up in the fullness of time to start a third world war with Russia for those regimes. And Mr. Soros every few years keeps changing the regimes in those countries to make sure that they stay on the boil and don't get too sensible.
Indeed. Now, we're running out of time, but let's move on to that. This, speaking of Russia and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, their headline is "Kremlin slams US for questioning of Russian MP by FBI in New York." What is this all about?
This young lady I forget her surname right now, Inga, is 34 years old. She was a radio show host in Russia first. She's obviously suffered from her looks, but she's a serious lady. She studied petroleum engineering first before going for her diplomat studies. And now she has been put on the party list to represent her party in the senior house of Russian parliament, the state council. And in that capacity, she's on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And she's one of the very few, if not the only one, that's of that contingent that was allowed a US visa to go to these Fort Ross meetings, where it's one of the few civil society meetings left where Americans and Russians can speak with the heat off slightly and try to resolve things. And as I alluded to earlier in the broadcast, no sooner did she land than she was taken into a side room, had all her documents taken off her, asked some rather suggestive questions by the sound of it. There's on screen now coming up is the Russian embassy in the USA's protest about this, asked inappropriate questions, and then asked to go to a separate room, and an FBI officer who introduced himself started to question her for an hour. And then this is when she gets the chat up line, "Come on, darling, you know, we can go around the corner and make this more comfortable." I suspect, given that she is an ethnic Bashkir as well as a striking looking woman, that what's gone on here is she's been told, "Well, you can report on Russia's Muslim ethnicities to us," which, of course, is not even the FBI's job. It's the CIA that's supposed to be running such assets. Unprecedented for this kind of approach to happen. And it's obviously going to have major repercussions for American politicians, including congressmen and senators visiting the Russian Federation.
OK, now I'm going to kind of hijack you quickly with this one, Alex, because this is Russi reporting yesterday that Russi is partnering with GCHQ for research project on AI and national security policy. So they're saying Russi has been commissioned by GCHQ to conduct a research study on the use of artificial intelligence for national security purposes. The overall aim of the project is to establish an independent evidence base to inform future government policy development and strategic thinking, regarding the national security issues of AI. As part of this project, Russi researchers are consulting widely with practitioners and policymakers from across government, academics, legal experts, technologists, and other subject matter experts. Russi's final report for this will be published in spring 2020. So, is this a normal thing, Alex, that GCHQ would outsource this type of work to an organisation like Russi? Is it a surprise that GCHQ is looking at the uses of AI with respect to national security?
It is completely unprecedented to my knowledge. GCHQ has the staff in-house to do this analysis, and I think the statement you read out makes clear why this unprecedented move has happened. It's because the appearance of independent advice is required in this place. Obviously, what they're going to go on to do, because RUSI is funded by the EU as well, and by the usual crowd, the British government in various ways, RUSI is going to go on to say that we need multinational solutions, we need closer collaboration between foreign intelligence services on the AI threat, perhaps active use of AI ourselves. And of course, GCHQ is perfectly capable of doing this itself. In fact, it emphatically in the past has been a policy setting department, particularly the arm of it, which is now called the National Cybersecurity Centre, is the British government's policy setting agency for resisting threats in cyberspace. So there is perfect precedent for GCHQ issuing a policy note on its own regard as an agency of the Foreign Office. But no, it has to go to RUSI, which is, of course, a very dark soup when we start stirring it, as you found out with military union questions.
Absolutely. Now, we're completely out of time, but I just wanted to end with this story, which was a late entry sent over by you earlier on. This is Craig Murray's blog, and the headline is Jonathan Sokoulis is not and has never been a diplomat. Well, it's interesting that Murray has updated the blog since he originally published it. To say that the mainstream media appears to be now acknowledging the fact that Jonathan Sokoulis is not and has never been a diplomat. And for those that aren't quite sure what this is about, it's about the death of, I believe, a 13-year-old boy outside an RAF base who was run over by the wife of somebody who had been claimed to be a diplomat. She has now absconded from the country. And, of course, Boris Johnson a couple of days ago was on the phone to Donald Trump to try to get her sent back to the UK. But as Craig Murray's saying here, this guy is not on any of the diplomatic lists, and therefore she should not have diplomatic immunity. Alex, again, I'm going to hijack it a little bit here with a question. And my question is this, because Donald Trump, in the statements that he's been making over the last couple of weeks, is clearly come to the realization, finally, that Britain, well, the three countries that he named were Britain, Italy and Australia, as being particularly implicated in the whole Russiagate nonsense and stirring that up and creating the problem for him in the first place. Do you think his refusal to allow this lady to be brought back to the UK is related to his general disgruntlement with the UK over the activities of Dear Love and Steel?
I wouldn't put it past him for that, and I would understand it if that's the case, because, of course, Mr. Trump has had property in Britain before. He's driven in Britain, as he said in those very remarks. He himself knew, and for me coming to the continent, I had it the other way around. It's very easy, sadly, to swing out onto a dual carriageway in particular and go the wrong way if it's the other side of the road to what you're used to. But yes, he's got no inherent animosity to the British people. It's very sudden and unexpected, I think, for Mr. Trump to discover this. And by the day, we get more Eastern European countries dragged into this, as Mr. Trump's lawyer, Mr. Giuliani, mentions more and more scandals involving the Bidens and Ukraine and Romania. And who knows who's next? Moldova and Georgia, I expect, will be fairly high up the list after that. But yes, it does seem to be a response to that. By the way, Mr. Sokoulis and his wife, but it's the affiliation of the husband that's interesting, it's almost certain that he was working on imagery, satellite imagery, because the base that is mentioned here, RAF Croughton or Croughton, you hear both pronunciations, at the bottom end of Northamptonshire, is where the Americans moved most of their imagery from RAF Molesworth, which is where British equivalent Jarrick used to be based, and it was then announced that would close. So there are two categories of American spooks who are not on the diplomatic list. Of course, the State Department and the CIA guys are. NSA guys are not, and Craig Murray seems to have assumed perhaps that he was an NSA guy, but the other category, and this is the one I think that applies, is those who are working with satellite and space imagery for war targeting, basically, and they do it on British soil for various legal get-arounds. There's no reason inherently for the US Air Force or the geospatial agencies to have staff in Britain, but they do it for the sake of embedding and getting around legal requirements of the US Constitution. So it's not an inherently key area, as it were. It's not the more controversial NSA-GCHQ relationship that's at stake here. So I think that adds more credence to the idea that Mr. Trump saying, no, she's not coming back, is actually a fit of pique based on what he knows about British spooks in general now.
Yes, okay. Look, Alex, thank you very much for that, and thank you very much for joining us today. We're absolutely out of time, so we need to finish there. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time as usual, 1 p.m. on Monday, and we hope to see you then. Bye-bye.